Welcome to It's the Economy on KGNU. Tonight, we'll hear from the first annual Regenerative Future Summit. It took place earlier this week at CU Boulder, and it brought together participants from across different sectors, business executives, entrepreneurs, economists, and they all discussed how we can have an economic system that best serves the needs of people and the environment. Later in the show, we'll hear from two of the keynote speakers, John Fullerton, founder and president of Capital Institute, and author Kate Raworth. Her book is Donut Economics. But first, here's Hunter Lovins of Natural Capitalism Solutions, one of the organizers of the event.
My name is Hunter Lovins. I am the president of Natural Capitalism Solutions. We and a whole host of other folk are honored to welcome you to what is badged as the first annual Regenerative Future Summit. And I say badged as because this is not exactly the first. This is part of an ongoing process, series. This began, I suppose, officially or unofficially, Bob, 5 years ago when the King of Bhutan invited a group of us to come to Bhutan, well, first of all to the UN, and thence to Bhutan, to see if we could take Bhutan's concept of gross national happiness and use that as the basis of international development policy. Like, wow, that sounded like a good idea. Out of that, we created a little organization called Alliance for Sustainability and Prosperity, ASAP. Cool, huh? And ASAP Bob and Ida are now from Australia, Stuart's from the UK. How many nationalities do we have? 7-8 nationalities as part of ASAP. Then I ran into Dr. Michael Pearson. Michael, where yet? Come on up. Michael is German, so another nationality added. Professor at Fordham, Michael and I started talking about how can we embed this stuff into universities, how can we spread it more broadly. Michael is the founder of a thing called the Humanistic Management Network, 7,000 people, 30-odd, I think, at least 30-odd, universities around. Sandra, where are you at? Come on up. Sandra Waddock from Boston College is part of Michael's network, also part of Leading for Wellbeing. Michael was working with OECD, Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. They've got, 37 countries? Member countries. This is the Rich Countries Club. So a group of us went off to OECD this spring and got them actually to agree to start taking the concept of human well-being as an alternative to gross national product. Kind of amazing, yeah? This owes to work that Bob and Ida have been doing of alternatives to GDP, what's wrong with GDP, and owes back to the work we were doing with the King of Bhutan. We had a summit last May at Fordham University. Donna Morton, Dr. Chris Laszlo, and what did we have, 80-odd people. We then had another meeting in Tübingen, Germany at the Institute for Global Ethics, another 80-odd people, 16 countries. So you are now part of the family. Welcome to Regenerative Futures, Alliance for Sustainability and Prosperity, Leading for Wellbeing Institute, or Humanistic Management Institute. And at one point, Chris and I got in a fight in Paris over who's running this thing. And I said, boys, we're arguing over who's captain of a rowboat. Nobody's running it. I'm sure not running it. You guys are running it. And the goal for the next 3 days, 2.5 days, is to bring coherence to this network of networks, to create coherence in a movement that already exists. Each of you are part of some other organization, and we need all of us. All of us are smarter than, stronger than, better than any of us. And that's what it's going to take. As we stand at the edge of a cliff, humanity could go away. Dr. Peter Turchin, University of Connecticut, humanity collapses within 10 years. These quotes that have been going around, Dr. Sylvia Earle, what we do in the next 10 years matters more than what humanity does in the next 10,000. We're up against it. Who's it? Winston Churchill said, Americans can be counted on to do the right thing when they've exhausted all alternatives. We're getting kind of close. There are a lot of people who were responsible for making this happen. In particular, I want to thank KGNU. This is Boulder's radio station. Without KGNU, the world wouldn't be knowing what it is that we're doing here. They have a booth right out front. Really urge you to get a hold of them. They broadcast Boulder, Denver, Nederland, Fort Collins, and online at kgnu.org and afterfm.com. Get involved. Become a sponsor. In this world, a lot of us are used to stuff for free. The radio comes to us for free. A lot of the great news services come to us for free. Let's start chipping in for those services that we depend on, yeah? So everybody go make a donation to KGNU. Thank them for being here. This is not your grandma's conference. They're kind of two kinds of conferences now. They're the pay-to-play, where anybody who's standing on the podium has put in $10,000 to grab that spot. Not like that here. Nobody paid to come here. The other is you just have eminent people who lecture at you. You go, oh, that's very interesting. You go away, and then nothing happens. This is not going to be like this. You're the conference. We are going to set the frame today. We will have on the podium people who have created the frameworks that we're now using when we talk about regenerative economy, about donut economics, about ecological economics. Stuart here was the founder for 20 years ran New Economics Foundation. The word New Economics was framed here. Throughout the rest of the 2 days, we'll have people coming up doing panels that are helping to frame the conversation. But the guts of this conference is you working. We have working groups. The working groups are structured around three different contact areas. One is some work that Michael, Chris, those of us in Leading for Wellbeing did last spring and at the May meeting. It's called the Meadows Memorandum. You should all have a copy of it. There are copies out front if you don't. This came out, and Stuart will talk a bit more later about how the Powell Memorandum came to be. If you haven't read the Powell Memorandum, go online, download it, and read it, and prepare to be chilled, because it'll show you how we got into the trouble we're in now. It was very deliberately laid out by one man, executed by some people with a lot of money. And when Mr. Trump walked into the Oval Office, remember that deer in headlights look on his face? Like, I won. He was handed a playbook written by the Heritage Foundation, one of those institutions created after the Powell Memorandum. These guys are very powerful. They have an agenda. And it, I submit, is the agenda that is bringing humanity to the edge of a cliff. We believe a finer future is possible. Much of what we talk about goes back to people like Bucky Fuller, E.F. Schumacher, Hazel Henderson. Hazel's still alive, so honors to Hazel. I am deeply honored to introduce my friend John Fullerton. When we were doing the stuff with Bhutan, the King of Bhutan came up to me and said, Hunter, your job is to reinvent the global economy. Like, me? So I went around asking everybody I knew who was smarter than me. Asked a man named Rick Stuckey, who was teaching finance at the Bard MBA where I teach. Rick said, yeah, I'll help, but you don't want to talk to me. You want to talk to John Fullerton. John was 18 years at J.P. Morgan, helped invent their derivatives practice, managed that, private equity, commodities from Tokyo to London to Wall Street. In 2001, he walked away. Just said, there is something rotten here, and walked away to read for 6 years. His wife said he was clinically depressed. He said, I may have been. If he'd have done that in a in an academic context, he'd had a couple PhDs. And then he started writing. And he read Bookie, read E.F. Schumacher, read Natural Capitalism, read Herman Daly. And then he started writing. Highly recommend you go to capitalinstitute.org and download, one, his paper, Regenerative Capitalism, and two, subscribe to his blog. It's when John and I met, we literally walked into each other at a Savory Institute meeting here in Boulder. I'd been looking for him and hadn't quite got around to finding him. And he walked up, said, "Hi, my name's John Fullerton. Rick Stuckey said we should talk." Like, well, howdy. So we started talking and have been working together ever since. He sent me a draft of Regenerative Capitalism. I read it on a trip to Germany and wrote him back and said, wow. Said, this is the best I've seen in 40-odd years of looking. So when we picked the name for this summit, it had to be regenerative. And this, I think, is if you get nothing else out of these days, and you're going to get a lot, if you get nothing else, please try to grasp these concepts of what it means to be regenerative. With that, I give you John Fullerton.
So I want to dive right into this and tell you how I got to this. I spent years in a deep think mode because I read Limits to Growth, and I understood the implications of exponential growth on a finite planet, and I understood as a finance person that finance is organized around the exponential growth function, and that it drives the economy, and that we were in this irreconcilable conflict between exponential growth on a finite planet. And I, it'd be easy to kind of get sort of into the happy talk of impact investing and ESG and make markets transparent and blah, blah, blah. And all of that work is really good work. But I was afraid. And I wanted to dig really deep and understand a honest foundation to be fearless from. And I discovered this idea of regenerative systems through my work with the Savory Institute. Is Danielle here? Danielle's here. So the Savory Institute, as you'll learn tomorrow, is involved in regenerative agriculture, a particular type of regenerative agriculture on the large landscapes, pastoral landscapes. And from my understanding of systems, it occurred to me that if holistic management of large landscapes is regenerative, and there are universal patterns and principles that govern the way the universe works, there was no reason why those same principles and patterns shouldn't be extended and applied to economy. And so I went about trying to figure out what that would look like. And the result of that, sort of the first result of that, was the paper that that Hunter mentioned. And this is ongoing work, and this work is really building on the work of everyone that was standing on this stage and many, many others that are not here today. But think of it as a container. This is not instead of other ideas. It's a container that holds ideas, but importantly, is grounded not in rules or models or tools, but is grounded in principles. And I think when we acknowledge that we're running the world on a system that is fundamentally flawed, we need to kind of pause and get back to first principles. And so that's what I've attempted to do, and I'm happy to say that that I've come out of it feeling quite hopeful, and I'm not quite sure I'm fearless yet, but I feel confident that there's actually a logical, scientific pathway forward. And the word regeneration has natural appeal, I think, to most people. Turns out it's actually a very rigorous scientific idea, as well as I would argue, a spiritual idea. And so I think it holds great promise. Now, before we get to the story, those of us sitting in the United States sometimes miss what's happening because our TVs are bombarded with other news. But the crisis, the refugee crisis, and this data actually extends beyond refugees to a concept the UN calls persons of concern. And, you know, something has changed, and it's accelerated in the last 10 years. And it's staggering that there are now 60 million people, more than 60 million people, that are persons of concern. And I think the refugee crisis is a sort of a leading indicator of this issue of collapse, because it encompasses all of the issues, from climate change to inequality to corruption to drought to, terrorism, that are the, you know, kind of the issues that we need to be concerned about. And so the escalating slope of that curve is something that I think summarizes nicely the predicament we're in. And of course, a couple of years ago, a French economist named Thomas Piketty, I hope I pronounced that correctly, wrote a book that became a bestseller, sold millions of copies, it's 700 pages thick, about economics. And, like most of you, if you have the book, you've probably not read it all. I haven't read it all, but I've read bits of it. But, you know, the basic idea is that it turns out that if you have capital, you get richer. And if you don't have capital, and if you're in debt, you don't get richer. And that you compound that forward over hundreds of years, and you're going to have a very unequal society. And it's, you know, documented with pages and pages of data. So we're at a moment where our fundamental economic model has come into question. We've got accelerating consequences of that that I think the refugee data is probably one good indicator to understand it. And on top of that, we sit at this moment in time that's never happened before. The idea that we've entered a new ecological era that I'm sure most of you, if not all of you, are very familiar with. But that's reason enough to pause and think seriously and not race into, I got to find my solutions because, you know, I've got a deadline, a quarterly earnings, whatever the current context is. This is we should pause for years and get this right and, in my mind, get back to first principles. So I'm going to torture you a little bit and go into theory. And, you know, most people don't like to talk about theory and want to get into action. And I think one of the reasons we're stuck is that we've rushed too quickly into action without getting clear about theory. And theory, thank you, may be sort of unnecessary when the world is working reasonably well, but when the world is racing toward a cliff, I think we need to pause and think about theory. And this is Woody Tash here, by the way? I know he's coming. I stole this from Woody, so I have to give him. So since he's not here, I won't even admit it. But this is kind of the theory that we run the world on. And in case you can't read it, it says corporate leaders and financiers gather in a field outside Darien, Connecticut. That's not far from where I live, but I don't live in Darien. Where one of them claims to have seen the invisible hand of the marketplace. And so if you think about it, on the one hand, it's funny, but on the other hand, it's not funny. Because think about what we've been doing for 25 years in the kind of corporate sustainability space. We've assumed that markets are the best model, and therefore the only problem is that markets are imperfect. So we need to complete markets, that's an economics term, market completion, and we need to make markets more transparent, more accurate. But we never question whether markets are a tool that can solve the problems we have. So we are without thinking about it, we are hostage to the idea that markets provide, you know, that markets are the theory is that markets provide the solutions we need. And of course, markets are great for many, many things, but they're terrible at figuring out how to adjust behavior for something on a, you know, multi-decade timeframe like climate change. And the other thing we do is we assume that GDP growth leads to prosperity. And there's been obviously books and books and, you know, Bob and others here have done lots and lots of work in this. One thing we need to remember is the guy that invented the GNP indicator himself, who won a Nobel Prize for it, talk about a reductionist idea that didn't deserve a Nobel Prize, he himself warned that this should not be used as a measure of national well-being. So I would argue we're lost. It turns out that that economics, modern economics, is rooted in classical physics. And then it took this leap and jumped into a reliance on statistics because the world is an uncertain place. Well, it turns out the scientists who actually study the way the world actually works would say that most of the world is neither single cause and effect items, which was our 400-year-old understanding of physics, nor is it disconnected items, like, you know, the probability of rolling a 7 or a 4 on a dice is unrelated to the last time you rolled the dice. It turns out most of the world is organized complexity with intertwined causes. And we now know this intuitively. Everything's connected to everything. That's an idea that comes from our religious understanding as well as modern physics. But the reality is that our economics and finance models presume the world is disconnected. And all of the models that we use to run economies and to do policy are based on what's called econometrics, which is classic statistics. It can't possibly get us to the answers we want. And in case you need proof of that, go to the long-term capital management blow up in 1998, which is how I met Rick Stuckey, or go to the financial crisis in 2008. In our lifetimes, there's been two very clear examples of why these ideas are flawed, which doesn't mean that they're not useful tools, but they're not models of reality. So I would argue we need to, again, get back to first principles and rethink how to understand how an economy works. And this is where the holistic management that I learned through Alan Savory and his team at Savory Institute comes in. I believe we're in this shift, and this is going to not sound new to many of you, but we're in this shift from kind of a 400-year-old reductionist way of solving problems, break things that are complicated down to their simple parts and understand them, and shifting into this more holistic or networked way to think about complex problems and complexity itself. And this is happening in all domains of knowledge. So, for example, the modern medical paradigm is a very reductionist paradigm. If you have cancer, we'll study those cancer cells and try to understand how we could invent a medication to kill the cancer cells. If you take a holistic approach, you understand that your healthy immune system is your greatest asset to never get cancer in the first place. And we know now how to invest in our immune system. So a more integrated approach essentially figure out what we need to do to not get cancer in the first place is the new future in my knowledge of fighting cancer, even though the cancer industry and the cancer research is all focusing on trying to solve the problem, which is really a symptom of a failure in our immune system, which has more to do with, you know, our lifestyle, the food we eat and whatnot. And you know, you're surprised if we eat toxins, we're getting cancer. I mean, it doesn't take a genius to figure this out. But this is happening in education. This idea of transdisciplinary education is now rising, and it's hard to do, but it's definitely the new idea. In business, you know, it's well understood that shareholder value now is a flawed idea, even though 99% of the companies, public companies on the planet, still optimize shareholder value. And there's ideas about integrated value that's changing this. And even business models, not sort of theory, but business models like Amazon and Walmart, which are very reductionist and extractive, are being supplanted by newcomers like Alibaba. And if you want to be inspired, go listen to Jack Ma give a talk. Particularly, he did one at World Economic Forum, where he talked about Alibaba as a platform in service of its constituent partners, as opposed to, say, an Amazon, which you would think Alibaba is kind of like Amazon, but Amazon is very much about owning and controlling and extracting value and dominating. It's a very old paradigm business model, even though he's seen as a modern technologist. And by the way, Bezos came from Wall Street, no surprise. So I think this is kind of really big news, that we're in the midst of a very profound shift from what we call the modern era to a new era that some people are now calling the integral era. And so this is a once in 400 year shift that I'm talking about. And we don't think in 400 year timeframes, right? And of course, this isn't the first time we've shifted eras. So it's happened before. There's no reason why it can't happen again. is shifted from the medieval era, and when the scientific revolution happened, we shifted from a sort of a God's design, church-dominated era to a scientific era. And now I think the reason it feels so chaotic is we're in the midst of another great shift like this.
That's John Fullerton, founder and president of Capital Institute, one of the speakers at this week's Regenerative Future Summit. It took place at CU Boulder on Monday, Tuesday and Wednesday of this week. You're listening to It's the Economy on KGNU.
So let me just review a little bit how that went. You know, the Pope, this is Pope Paul V, felt very threatened by Copernicus and Galileo suggesting that the Earth's not the center of the universe, because if the Earth isn't at the center of the universe, it kind of conflicts with their understanding of the scripture. And so the church's, you know, in a sense, dominant role, power role in culture was very threatened. So, you know, Galileo was told to stop saying that the Earth stands at, that the sun is at the center of the universe. He spent many years of an uncomfortable life. And of course, the Pope couldn't stop the scientific revolution from happening. We had this massive outpouring of energy and empowerment, and led to the Enlightenment and creative outpouring. And we got all the way to the roughly present time, notice the red tie, where the new church is really the Church of Economics. And I'm not meaning to pick on poor Alan Greenspan, and he's not poor. But I use him as a metaphor for the Church of Economics. And he said, and this is his quote after the financial collapse, that the whole intellectual edifice of the modern financial risk management paradigm collapsed last summer. So even the Pope of Economics has acknowledged that the intellectual, you know, not that we made a mistake and it went wrong, but that the intellectual framework collapsed, meaning we're lost. And I would argue we still haven't figured out a replacement for it. But in the ultimate irony of modern times, we get a new pope, and here's what he writes. We urgently need a humanism capable of bringing together the different fields of knowledge, again, transdisciplinary, including economics, in the service of a more integral and integrating vision. Now, when I read that, I had actually just put out this paper. And so, in a sense, I've been working for years trying to come up with, you know, the 1.0 version of a pathway forward. And then the Pope, of all people on planet Earth, issues a call for essentially this integrating vision of an economic system. Now, this is by far not perfect, but when I read that, when I read the Pope's encyclical, and if you haven't read it, I highly urge you, it's a beautiful document, very well written. I'm not Catholic, this has nothing to do with religion. He understands the science and the connection of science and spirit and this need for a shift to an integral vision. So, economics for an integral age is another way to think about what regenerative economics is. And the idea here really is quite simple. It's that modern science understands a tremendous amount about the way the universe actually works, the physical universe actually works. And this is relatively new science, meaning in the last 50 years. So the science that my kids are taught in high school and even in college is often not updated for this more integral science. So that's a problem. But there is, you know, there is a mass amount of new understanding that is integral in the scientific community. And amazingly, it's largely at the high level, highly aligned with our wisdom traditions, indigenous, Eastern, and Western. So the hypothesis is that either the science, which increasingly agrees with the wisdom, is relevant to the human economy, and the human economy better shift it to be in accordance with those principles and patterns, or someone needs to make the case why the human economy is the one exception to the rule, that all systems on the universe operate in accordance with these principles and patterns. And my fear moved to fearlessness when I saw a pathway that, yes, our economy could actually align with these principles. And so what are the chances that I happened to live at the time that humanity went off the cliff and blew up in smoke. But we have a profound shift to make, which is far greater than I think most of us, even in these sustainability conversations, have yet to comprehend. So everyone always asks me, so what does regenerative economics mean? And by the way, you'll see I'm using the word economics now rather than capitalism. And you know, this is not about capitalism versus socialism. This is not about free markets or governments. And by the way, we also need a common sector if we're going to have that debate. This is bigger than that. This is a framework that we need to apply whether we want a big government sector or a small government sector, and whether we want markets to do more stuff or less stuff. Irregardless of the answer to that, and those debates I think go on and will go on forever, what we need to do is be having those debates around a different framework than we have right now, which is a regenerative framework. And so my colleagues and I at the Capital Institute, we debate all the time, but our current best definition of regenerative economics is the application of nature's laws and patterns, and the patterns are key, laws and patterns of systemic health, self-renewal, and regenerative vitality to socioeconomic systems. I don't know if that tells you what it is, but that's a short definition. And now I'm going to try to explain a little bit about what that means. So the first cool thing is that there are, in a sense, there's a hierarchy of systems or understanding in the real world that starts at the level of energy. Energy equals matter. Thank you, Mr. Einstein. And energy, everything is energy. This is energy. You know, we're all energy. The economy is energy. And so there are rules of energy flow, like systems only change in response to pressure. Those rules apply all the way up from the non-living energy matter level to the living systems, non-human, to human living systems, and even to consciousness. The people that understand consciousness, I'm not one of them, talk about consciousness as energy. So one of the rules and patterns is that what's true about energy matter has to be true all the way up, including has to apply to the human economy. There are other qualities of each of these layers that are unique to those layers. So consciousness is not all energy, even though energy is consciousness. Or I said that the wrong way around. There are things about non-living human systems, like metabolism, that apply to human living systems and economies. But there are things about humans, like trust and other values that are innately human, that obviously don't apply to bugs and deer and grass. But the idea is that there are universal principles and patterns that apply all the way up, and or that apply from a certain level up. And the idea of a regenerative economy is that those patterns and principles describe systems that have lasted for long periods of time in the real world. So why don't we think about applying them to our human economy? And if we do that, in the paper I wrote about 8 principles. And of course no one wants to hear about 8 principles. There's too many. But it's impossible to try to describe something that's inherently complex in as few as even 8 principles, much less fewer. And through the work of my science colleagues, we have a group called Research Alliance for Regenerative Economics, we've actually reduced the principles into 4 basic elements. And we could talk about each one of these for a long period of time, but this is a way to kind of grasp this at a high level. Let me start with structure. So we rarely talk about structure when we talk about economies. And what I mean by that is the combination of big, medium, and small enterprises. But if you think about, you know, a tree, or if you think about your cardiovascular system, or you think about a bolt of lightning, lightning is non-living. They all have what's called a fractal pattern, where there's a large piece, a bunch of branches, and then a bunch of twigs, essentially. And that's how energy gets dispersed efficiently. So it turns out that structure is critical for any system, living and non-living system. And so that tells us something different about, for example, the banking system. Do we need just little banks? No. Do we want just big monster banks? No. There's this relationship, a fractal relationship between a few large, many more medium, and then a bunch of small that actually can circulate, and this gets to the circulation point. Effective circulation requires these fractal patterns. So if an economy is metabolizing material and information and money, it can be enhanced if the structure looks like fractal. Other aspects of structure are balance. Starting with sort of a balance of masculine and feminine, but also a balance of efficiency and resiliency. There's lots of aspects of balance that, you know, your yoga teacher can teach us, but that are missing from our modern economic system. So structure and circulation really go very nicely together. And circulation, of course, is where the whole circular economy piece fits in. We need to have efficient circulation of materials when part of the key of circulation is we can't put waste into the system because it's all connected. The ecological economics framework made a huge advance, which Bob Costanza is one of the co-creators of, made a huge advance when it understood that the human economy is embedded in the biosphere. It's not apart from the biosphere. So once we know that's true, we have to know that we can't put unlimited amounts of CO2 in the atmosphere and think it's not going to come back to bite us. So robust circulation, healthy inputs into the system, and healthy outputs in the system are what we mean by circulation. And then the relationships and learning piece. Relationships are at the heart of any healthy system. And that's true. It's true at the level of our planet. The relationship between planet Earth and the sun is a perfect relationship, or we wouldn't be sitting here. And it's true at a very micro level. The relationship between two molecules of hydrogen and one molecule of oxygen in the right relationship creates water, which is the basis of all life. The relationship between our cells are essential. If you get cancer, it's because the relationship at a cellular level breaks down, the communication breaks down. And yet, what have we done in our economy? The pursuit of capital market efficiency has severed the relationship between owners and companies. And we wonder why companies can't be regenerative or sustainable. So I would argue that getting clear about healthy relationships and looking at our economy and seeing where those relationships are healthy and where they're not, and importantly, looking at the relationships at the edges, where one system or one type of enterprise, like the private sector and the public sector, or the common sector and the private sector, those edges are in relationship with each other, and those need to be nourished and need to be healthy. And then finally, it's about learning. The unique thing about humans compared to other living systems is we learn incredibly fast. We don't have to learn through generations of DNA transfer. We learn in real time while we're alive. And that's the key to remain hopeful here, is that we're not sort of static. We actually can change. And the science shows us that learning in relationships is the key to really break out and new thinking. And of course, that's this idea of collaboration. So we all know we need to collaborate more, and yet the science backs that up and says that learning relationships are the key to healthy living systems. And here's the punchline. We can't anticipate all of the potential out there in our kind of limited linear brains. But if these patterns and principles actually work, then we can tap into the potential that actually exists that we don't yet understand. And so it's not a linear, you know, we need to take this much carbon out of the atmosphere, we need to make inequality this much better. It's like once this happens, the magic starts. And if you think about, for example, the internet, which is a network, think about what's been made possible as a result of the internet being invented that no one anticipated even 10 years after the internet was in existence. And so my reason for hope is that if we can shift the economy more in alignment with these patterns and principles, lots and lots of potential will be unleashed that we don't know yet exists. And that's true for us as individuals as well, right? I mean, our regenerative ability as human beings gets unlocked, and we start doing things we never imagined we'd be doing. I certainly am a case in point. When I was sitting on Wall Street, I had no idea I'd be talking about regenerative economies. So I hope that gives you some sense of what I see as the kind of core patterns and principles. Another way to think about this is that most of the sustainability work has been moving from our conventional degenerative mechanistic design on the left, and we start moving toward this, what Ray Anderson called mount sustainability. We slowly but surely do things less badly. And that's key. I'm not here to ridicule that. Thank God we're doing that. But I would argue that to become sustainable, sustainable is really an outcome of a process, of a regenerative process. And so if we can shift our process to holistic thinking and natural system design aligned with the patterns and principles, the outcome will be sustainable, but we'll actually be in this regenerative, very dynamic mode in order for the outcome to be sustainable. Now, if that makes sense, and you start to think about it, it has profound implications for pretty much everything that has to do with economic systems, economic policy, corporations, finance, et cetera. And so, you know, for example, we need outcomes other than GDP. We know that. I will argue we need outcomes measures as well as intrinsic measures of health. Like when you go to the doctor, you measure your blood, they measure your blood pressure, not because you care about blood pressure per se, but because that's an intrinsic indicator of health or lack of health. This issue of inequality is obviously a huge issue, but it's not a question of, you know, we have just some moral obligation to deal with inequality. The empowered participation of all parts of a system are essential to the health of the system. So even if you're rich, you're going to be, and this, by the way, is backed up by research, even if you are rich and live in a rich country, if the system has massive injustice and inequality, the health of the whole system deteriorates as a result of it. So you have to care, even if you have no moral reason to care, about some balance of having all parts of the system empowered to participate and contribute to the system. The shareholder value paradigm is fatally flawed. Modern portfolio theory, the basic way that money is managed, is called modern portfolio theory. It's built on the same flawed statistics. The idea of an internal rate of return presumes that you can externalize everything other than the financial aspects of an investment project. That requires rethinking. Regulation. We have a largely kind of rules-driven regulation that's grounded in our ideology of free markets, blah, blah, blah. Well, if this structure of the system matters, then we need to have principles that guide regulation of industry, not just rules. And those principles will essentially radically shift the way we think about large, dominant, powerful enterprises that are extracting from, you know, essentially the middle and lower layers of the economy. And it's not just antitrust. The argument behind antitrust is, well, we need a competitive free market. Again, ideology. It's not we need a fractal structure where the powerful need to be in service of the whole or else they need to be essentially changed through policy. The speculation of financial markets. Speculation is inherently a win-lose proposition. If I buy IBM and you sell IBM and the stock goes up, I win, you lose. The financial markets have become a speculative casino in violation of the core principles of regenerative systems. I would argue that two-thirds of financial capital market activity is in violation of these principles and needs to be either taxed or regulated away. That will free up huge amounts of capital to invest in more productive reasons or productive opportunities. And on and on and on, fiscal policy, monetary policy. And at, you know, at the heart of it, and here's sort of looking at this through the lens of a finance guy, it kind of boils down to finance needs to fundamentally rethink its purpose and its role in a healthy economy. And this is kind of the way it looks to a finance person, right, and to an economist. Those with the money sort of allocate capital, and we do that in a way that essentially, you know, treats the planet as natural resources, treats humans as natural resources, pulls it all together in such a way that optimizes the return to financial capital, as if the goal is to return maximum return to financial capital. Well, that made some sense 200 years ago when financial capital was scarce and we were trying to mobilize enterprise. But now, you know, ecological capital is scarce and human capital is getting extracted. And so, you know, it doesn't take a genius to figure this out. We actually need to figure out how to put finance in a place of service to a real economy, which is understood to be embedded in the planet. And I think the key to doing this is coming up, you know, of course, we know we need to measure stuff, we need to use data, we need to be modern. This is not just kind of a metaphor. We need to actually be able to manage and operate this way. And my colleagues with, you know, within this research enterprise I mentioned earlier have come up with essentially three categories of intrinsic measures that relate to the core elements. One is the flow or circulation piece. One is the structural factors that I talked about earlier. And then the other is, for lack of a better term, we call them cultural factors. But we're on to, you know, we actually have now developed these measures and believe they're good indicators about whether an economy is regenerative or not. But more importantly, that, you know, we set a baseline and then we can measure over periods of time whether an economy is becoming more regenerative. And the idea of that is that if these indicators move in the right direction, the outcomes we actually care about should improve as well. So here's where it gets even harder. You know, we organize the world by nation states and corporations, but it turns out that these regenerative principles operate, you know, in real contexts around real places, real regions, real bioregions, real cities where people really live. And corporations now transcend across many, many of those. And nation states are somewhat arbitrary lines that are not aligned with how people live. In the United States, the South is very different from the West Coast. And so we need to do all this, in a sense, redesigning the unit of analysis that we're thinking about regenerative economies. So here's where local economy comes in. Local economy is not the answer, as if there's never such a thing as a global economy, but local economy or regional economy or bioregional economy is where the kind of the traction happens, where the rubber meets the road, where human relationships actually exist, where trust needs to be built or rebuilt. And this is we were up in Buffalo a couple of weeks ago launching a regenerative Buffalo workshop, and I just borrowed this this visual from them. But you know, you can define these, you know, in tight circles or medium circles or even broad circles. And the bioregion around Buffalo actually includes Toronto. So it crosses national boundaries, and it's linked together largely by the history of Niagara Falls and the canals that you know, commerce and whatnot used to flow through here. And that's sort of the common denominator of that place. Boulder has a very different story about its common denominator and its culture. And so imagine sort of where I see this work going. And we're doing another initiative in a town called Tottenville, which is on the south end of Staten Island, which is really kind of forgotten Trump country. You know, it's probably 90% Trump voters, mostly white, mostly had their local economy extracted and destroyed, and are very, very cynical about the future. And there's this new post-Hurricane Sandy investment happening offshore to create these big green ecosystem services, and that was going to happen with no connection to the community in Tottenville. And so what we're trying to do is link that big investment to regenerative design in Tottenville. But the idea here is, you know, imagine there being these place-based, place-sourced, as the Regenesis, our friends at Regenesis like to say, initiatives that are happening at the regional level, bioregional level, not, you know, community fine, but ideally at the regional level, that are knitted together with shared learning, shared approach to metrics, benchmarking. So we know that Boulder has a regenerative index of 44, and Buffalo has a regenerative index of 34, and there's learning between those two. And suddenly we connect these together, and there's 5, and there's 10, and there's 50, and there's 100 regenerative economies happening at this place-based level, connected together so learning happens fast. That, I think, is how this new economy will rise up. And suddenly, it'll be in the news. The new economy will be the story. It won't be these invisible one-off projects as opposed to, you know, the dominance of the big corporate paradigm. So that's sort of where I believe this is heading. It's the rest of our lifetime and work. This is not a new idea. Jane Jacobs was onto the exact same science 50 years ago, where she said, it's not how big you grow, it's how you grow big. So I hope that's useful and helpful and provides some context for the rest of the 3 days.
John Fullerton, founder and president of Capital Institute, speaking at the recent Regenerative Future Summit. It took place earlier this week at CU Boulder. You're listening to It's the Economy on KGNU. You can see the videos of all of the speakers from the summit at regenerativefuturesummit.org. Next, we'll hear part of the keynote talk given by Kate Raworth.
Kate Raworth was at Oxfam, the great international organization doing development work. Then at Oxford, teaching, where you still teach, yeah? Professor at Oxford. But to my mind, one of the seminal best thinkers in what's wrong with economics today and what we ought to be doing about it. How do we rewrite economics so that it makes sense? And so I wrote to Kate and said, any chance, please, you could come all the way from the UK? And she said, well, I'm in the US anyway doing a book tour for my new book, Donut Economics. Would I be willing to write a blurb for it? Yes, I'd be honored. And so, from the luck of your publisher, we have Kate Raworth with us, all the way from Oxford. Well, just more recently from the World Bank, where she was teaching the World Bank how to have economics that make any sense.
So, who the heck am I, this woman from England? I went to university to study economics 25 years ago, and I was really frustrated by what I was taught, because I wanted to change the world. I mean, who wouldn't? And everything that I cared about, like social justice, like environmental integrity, was pushed to the margins of the theory. So I walked away from economics, too embarrassed ever to call myself an economist, because who'd want to admit to being that? And so I immersed myself in real-world challenges. I worked 3 years in the villages of Zanzibar, 4 years at the UN, a decade with Oxfam. I had twins, immersed myself in the care economy, from which there is no going back. And I realize you can't walk away from economics because it frames the world we live in. It's the mother tongue of public policy. And so I decided it was time to walk back towards economics and flip it on its head. And what if we could rewrite economics so that it actually started to help create the world we want? And that's what I've spent the last 3 years doing, writing this book. And it's been a privilege. I've been supported by the Candida Fund, which enabled me to really focus on writing this book and to be here. So let me kick off with a quote that hugely has inspired me, and I know inspires many people here. Bucky Fuller, you never change things by fighting the existing reality. To change something, build a new model that makes the existing model obsolete. Sometimes the best form of protest is to propose something. And so I set out to draw a picture of the world that we want to create. What would that look like? And here it is, it's a donut. And I hope you've all got this little two-pager on your chairs. So in the middle of that donut, in the hole, is a place where people are falling short on life's essentials, be it food, health, education, decent housing, energy, jobs, income. And we want to get everybody in the world out of that hole. Those 12 social priorities are actually the 12 social priorities set out in the Global Sustainable Development Goals. So I've crowdsourced them from the world's governments. You could say they're the most contemporary expression by humanity of what we commonly agree are the minimum standards for human well-being. So we want to get everybody out of that shortfall in the middle and into the donut itself. But we cannot overshoot the outer crust of the donut, because there we are putting so much pressure on our living planet that we start to kick it out of kilter, causing climate change, chemical pollution, biodiversity loss, air pollution, ozone depletion. We begin to challenge the fundamental Earth life-giving systems on which we all fundamentally depend. And these 9 Earth system processes are the 9 planetary boundaries created by Earth system scientists such as Johan Rockström and Will Steffen in 2009. So it's the latest expression of how we understand our planet operates and how it depends upon these critical systems for staying in the extraordinary balance that's been so benevolent to humanity for the last 11,000 years. So here's a possible compass for the 21st century. How do we meet the needs of all within the means of the planet? How do we get everybody out of that space of shortfall without going into overshoot? Well, if you have a compass, the first thing you need to know is where's the needle pointing? And the needle's pointing, it's not surprising, but it's quite challenging to look at. Because today, many millions of people still live in that space of shortfall. 11% of people in the world don't have enough food to eat. 9% of people have only dirty water to drink and clean with every day. 32% of people don't have access to improved sanitation. They don't have a basic toilet to use. So there's massive shortfall in countries rich and poor. And yet we've already overshot at least 4 planetary boundaries. The ecological ceiling for climate change is 350 parts per million of carbon dioxide. Last month, we went over 410 parts per million. We're also over on excessive fertilizer use, nitrogen phosphorus loading, on land conversion, on biodiversity loss. And we don't even know where we are on chemical and air pollution. We could be over those too. So I think this is our challenge of the century. How do we meet the needs of all within the means of the planet? Because right now, we're going to go down as the era of reckless overshoot. That is how history will remember us. Can we turn that legacy around? Can we actually become remembered by our great-great-grandchildren as the generation that started to put humanity on track for thriving in balance, in prosperity together? That, I think, is our generational question. I'm excited, because this is challenging and pretty depressing, I'm excited when people come to me with solutions they're already creating. So I was contacted recently by some land developers, some urban developers in Stockholm. They said, we're creating a new suburb of Stockholm about 15 minutes by train from downtown. And we love this donut because we're using it as a blueprint for the place we're creating. How can we meet the needs of all the inhabitants in this new district for food, health, education, schools, transport, energy, jobs, within the means of the planet, was respecting the ecosystem in which we're embedding this community. And they've just had a meeting this past week to start developing what would it look like to do this. I was also contacted by a group in South Africa who said, we're revisioning the future of our town called Kokstad, the fastest growing town in KwaZulu-Natal. And they got together with the municipality and the youth, and they used the donut to start envisaging what kind of future do we want to create and design for our town. And the youth of the town said, we want to add something into that social foundation. They added in fun, because they said, it's got to be fun transforming your economy, right? So I'm excited because I think some of these people are the 21st century designers of the future, creating, as John was saying, creating specific places. This future is beginning to emerge. But I'll tell you what makes me angry. It's when you go to one of these places, Department of Economics. Who in the room has ever studied just at least a little bit of economics? Oh my God, I feel your pain. Okay, so we've all been there, and maybe some of your children are going there now or thinking of going there now. So what are they learning? Here's the problem. The students of today who are studying economics because they want to change the world, they're the policymakers of 2050. But they are being taught economics from the textbooks of 1950 based on the theories of 1850. And given the challenges of the 21st century, from climate change to extreme inequality to repeated financial crash, this is shaping up to be a disaster. We know that we need a new economic story.
Kate Raworth, author of Donut Economics, 7 Ways to Think Like a 21st Century Economist. Earlier, we heard from John Fullerton, founder and president of Capital Institute, and Hunter Lovins of Natural Capitalism Solutions. They were all speaking at the first Regenerative Future Summit that took place at CU Boulder earlier this week. To see the entire talk by Kate Raworth and to hear other speakers from the summit, go to regenerativefuturesummit.org. Thanks for listening to It's the Economy on KGNU. Stay tuned for Highway 322.